listening to Sasha and Marsh with the tune Dead Cynthia. Clock, Max Amorth before that with Stopping from the Piano Swag EP. We also had Animal Friend before that with Stoken, the Sleight of Hands remix. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. That's about it for this show. If you want to get in touch with me if you missed the show, my website is at djfirefly.com.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll focus on recent Supreme Court decisions that can allow President Trump to dismantle numerous government agencies, including the Department of Education. We'll also follow up on the closely watched trial of the case, American Association of University Professors versus Rubio.
We're glad to have our very own Stephen Rohde, a constitutional scholar, speak to us about the implications of these dire attacks on democracy. We then take a look at the MAGA ideology with returning guest, Monthly Review editor John Bellamy Foster.
We'll discuss his recent Monthly Review article titled The MAGA Ideology and the Trump Regime.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
This half hour, we continue our ongoing effort to understand in real time the upheavals taking place within our U.S. government, as well as the blitz of attacks on the rule of law, and that includes attacks on judges, lawyers, academics, students, and virtually anyone else who is critical of the Trump administration's policies and actions. Today, we'll be particularly focused on recent Supreme Court decisions that have paved the way for Trump to dismantle the Department of Education and numerous government agencies. The decisions also limit the public's ability to challenge government overreach and have led to swift deportations to countries in which detainees have no prior connection. We'll also follow up on the critically important First Amendment and Academic Freedom case, American Association of University Professors versus Rubio, which is in trial right now in Boston. Our guest on this subject is our very own co-host, Stephen Rohde. He is a legal scholar, writer, lecturer, and political activist who practiced civil rights and civil liberties law for over 50 years. He's past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He's also a co-founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace and a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He hosts the podcast Speaking Freely and is, of course, a co-host here on Law and Disorder. Of course, Mr. Rohde is speaking only for himself today. Stephen Rohde, welcome to the guest seat on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with both of you today.
Well, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to allow the Trump administration to gut the Department of Education, a decision that Ian Millhiser of Vox magazine called the biggest victory of Trump's second term. The decision was one of many controversial decisions that was heard on the court's so-called shadow docket. Tell us about the case and the shadow docket.
Thank you. Yes, we're going to be talking about this shadow docket. I'm beginning to call it the shameful docket. I think listeners presume that when a Supreme Court decision comes out, it's gone through the process. There's been briefing. There have been the availability of amicus briefs. There has been an oral argument. The judges have conferenced and come up with a decision, issue that decision with reasoning and analysis and legal authorities, and sometimes there are dissents that disagree with the majority opinion. Well, this season in the Supreme Court, they have elevated what are called emergency applications for a stay. It is having a nefarious impact on the law and on American society. Trump has been sued upwards of 400 times since he came into office. His lawlessness has been recognized by district judges and appellate court judges across the country in very important cases. In many of those cases, either temporary restraining orders have been granted or preliminary injunctions, and the government has appealed those cases. But not only have they appealed it to trigger what I described as the normal process a moment ago, but they immediately go into the Supreme Court, which they know is favorable to them, with six arch-conservative justices in control of the Supreme Court, three of whom were appointed by Trump himself. And they have exploited this emergency stay process. And that's what's called the shadow docket in commentary and discussions. In a shadow docket case, all they do is read a few briefs, very short applications written in this case by the government on one side and the parties on the other side, and they can issue an opinion. In this case, the government has to show a likelihood of overturning the injunction from the lower courts. They have to show irreparable injury if the Supreme Court doesn't stay the injunctions, and they have to show that it's in the public interest to stay what the lower courts have done. And what is so shocking, I think we've talked about national injunctions that came up in the Birthright case, in cases we'll talk about today. The conservative majority literally issues a one paragraph or sometimes a few paragraphs, often without any reasoning, any case citations, any explanation of why they are staying what both lower courts have done. And this case demonstrates that in spades. Here is the Department of Education, an agency created by Congress, although it's lodged in the executive branch, as all administrative agencies are. And the Department of Education has functioned for decades, but Donald Trump is putting that to an end. He's issued an executive order to step-by-step to dismantle the Department of Education. We could spend a lot more time on that underlying plan. He wants to dumb down the United States. He wants to shift responsibilities to the states, which are themselves struggling with expenses. In this case, he purported to freeze billions of dollars, which included after-school programs and summer programs and all the rest of the mainstream activities that the Department of Education supports. Well, when he issued that order and when his Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, began dismantling the Department of Education, the American Federation of Teachers, 20 state attorneys general and D.C. attorney general, two school districts and other unions went into court in Massachusetts. And on May 22nd, U.S. District Judge Myung Yoon granted a preliminary injunction after a full-dress hearing with evidence, with sworn declarations, and all the rest. And that judge, that district judge, found that to restore the department to its status quo, she was granting that injunction. It required rehiring hundreds of employees that had been told in March they would lose their jobs. She found that what Trump was doing would likely cripple the department. Over 1,400 employees were affected by this. Now, she used the right word, status quo. The status quo is a Department of Education fully functioning for the last 50 years. The injunction simply maintains the status quo. But what the Supreme Court has done is disrupt the status quo and allow Trump to proceed with his plan. On June 4, the First Circuit Court of Appeals denied Trump's request for a stay. That court held that deep staff cuts made it effectively impossible for the department to carry out its statutory functions. Nevertheless, in a pattern that's emerging, the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision on July 14, granted this stay, which allows Trump to proceed. In dissent, the three dissenters written, and this dissent was written by Sotomayor, said it was indefensible. She said it hands the executive the power to repeal statutes by firing all those necessary to carry them out. The majority is either willfully blind to the implications of its ruling or naive, but either way, the threat to our constitutional separation of powers is grave. And that's what's at the heart of this and other things we'll be discussing today. The separation of powers and checks and balances. This department was established by Congress. If it's going to be changed or modified, that must be done through Congress. And this is another dark blemish on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, it certainly is, Steve. It's an attack on the concept of democracy. In addition to the attacking the Department of Education, the Supreme Court also just cleared the way for Trump's administration to continue the planned massive government layoffs and downsizing of numerous other government agencies, which had been paused by the lower courts. What'll be the consequences, and will there be any room to challenge executive orders that mandate such sweeping changes to our government structure?
Yes, this is just the next example in the shadow document. All of what you described is happening. Even though the lower courts had ruled Trump cannot dismantle the federal workforce with the strike of a Sharpie and dismantle federal agencies. This involves the loss of jobs for tens of thousands of employees at agencies, including the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the State Department, the Treasury Department. This order is strangling these important federal agencies. Yet, in this case, in a two-paragraph order, the justices wrote that they had concluded that the government is likely to succeed on its argument that Donald Trump's executive order announcing plans to downsize the government are legal. The justices added that they are not expressing a view on the legality of specific layoffs or reorganizations by the Trump administration. Now, that's another wrinkle that the Supreme Court has introduced. Some of these shadow docket rulings are confusing and give no guidance to the lower courts. A few weeks ago, we were expecting a ruling on birthright citizenship, and instead the court issued an opinion saying national injunctions could not be granted by district judges, that individuals who were affected had to bring their own individual lawsuits. It was shocking in the area of birthright citizenship that every pregnant mother about to give birth to a child who should be recognized as an American citizen, that every one of them would have to bring a lawsuit in their own district court. Well, in this case, involving the federal employees that are being fired, the Supreme Court introduced that concept as well by saying that separate rulings by each agency could be challenged. Now, it's a little surprising, and I'm always candid with you, that this was an 8-1 decision. The only dissenter was the outspoken Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is proving to be a voice of reason and due process. She dissented. Justice Sotomayor, who's been equally outspoken, wrote a concurrence, and maybe she saw the writing on the wall and she was hinting to litigators that this decision did not foreclose attacks on individual federal agencies and their individual cutbacks. I think Sotomayor and Kagan, who joined in this particular decision, may have counted the votes. They knew they were losing, and they used a concurrence, which can be cited in lower courts, hinting that individual cases will have to be brought for each agency. That just is an example of the quagmire and chaos that the Supreme Court is adding to the chaos created by Donald Trump.
Stephen Rohde, on June 27th, six members of the Supreme Court signed on to a decision in a case called Trump versus CASA that limits nationwide injunctions against the Trump administration. The three dissenting justices called the decision shameful. In response, civil rights lawyers found an innovative approach to try to work around the devastating impact of the decision. What's going on in those cases?
Yes, I previewed this. The CASA case is a very serious and damaging case because it speaks not only to the birthright case that in which it arose, but to approximately 20 injunctions around the country in which district judges and appellate court judges have found that to give complete relief, they must grant the injunction nationwide, not just for the district they preside in and where the parties may be. Now, the case was brought by 22 states, and the lower courts found the attempt by the Trump administration to overturn the 14th Amendment, which says that all persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States. That's been the law since that amendment was enacted. So when you have a blatant unconstitutional act by the executive, the dissenters, in this case three dissenters, asked, why are we allowing any lawlessness to go forward? Why is the Supreme Court indulging Trump to create a law-free zone where he can continue his mischief when we know at the end of the day that what he's doing is unconstitutional? Well, the majority did leave open the possibility of class actions. A class action is brought by a handful of plaintiffs, and they sue on behalf of themselves and all similarly situated persons because they believe there is commonality to the case. The legal issues are the same for all members of the class. However, certification of class actions can take months. It can be litigated by itself. So the majority was throwing a sop to that side of the case. Well, fortunately, the good lawyers in one case, the ACLU, the Legal Defense Fund, the Asian Law Caucus, Democracy Defenders Fund, they were ready for this in a case called Barbara et al. Versus Trump. And within hours of the Supreme Court's case, generally banning national injunctions, they amended their complaint to seek a class action. And I will say in the CASA case itself, that's filed in Maryland by the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. I pause to mention some of these groups that are bringing these lawsuits. Brilliant, hardworking lawyers in 400 lawsuits across the country are on the front lines in the first defense against what Trump is doing. Well, Last week in the Barbara versus Trump case, the ACLU case, the judge held a hearing and he provisionally certified a class. And the class was defined exactly the way Trump defined his executive order as to any children and babies born after February of this year. He granted a preliminary injunction in support of the class, and now that's going to be litigated. It's really going to test the Supreme Court. Do they mean what they say? If they created an exception for class actions, well, now it's a class action, and are they instead nefariously working behind the scenes simply to support Trump?
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my fellow co-host, Maria Hall. We're speaking with Steve Rohde, who's usually a co-host, but now is our guest. Steve, on the 4th of July, 8 men were deported from U.S. military bases in Africa to South Sudan. This made headlines because the deportations had been blocked by a federal court, but the Supreme Court then allowed them to go forward. Only one of them had any connection to South Sudan. Tell us a little bit about how these men ended up in a U.S. military base in Africa and how the court reached its conclusion.
Well, once again, the shadow docket has struck, and in this case, affecting the real lives of 8 men who were in the grips of the ICE immigration system in the United States. And it's having very real-life damaging consequences. In March, Judge Brian Murphy of the U.S. District Court in Boston held hearings over the fact that, contrary to general practices, the Trump administration is trying to deport immigrants not to their home country, which is what is expected and means that people are returned to where they have family and human contacts. Instead, in this case, the government had selected 8 men to send them to South Sudan, the violence-plagued African country, which virtually all of these men had never set foot in. Judge Murphy intervened. He ordered them to stop. And he claimed that the government was manufacturing the very chaos that they were decrying. The case was on hold because of that injunction. The circuit court would not grant the Trump administration a stay. Yet on June 23rd, the stay was granted, in this case, 6-3, with a powerful dissent. Now, the district judge was doing the hard work district judges do most often, and he had issued a second order, which was requiring hearings and an opportunity to appeal those deportations to South Sudan. It was unclear because the Supreme Court's shadow docket decision was vague and brief and opaque, and instead the government appealed that order, and instead of criticizing the government, the majority criticized the district judge for not following their vague order. So many of those men are headed to South Sudan. We are hoping that international oversight will give us some idea of what's happening, and it mirrors what the Trump administration is doing in the notorious El Salvador prison and even in sending people to Guantanamo Bay.
Let's now turn to the subject of freedom of speech. Last week on the show, we were joined by attorney George Wang, who told us about a very important case on this issue. Steve, remind us about the case and what's been happening in the trial court.
Well, this is a case, again, of very serious importance. It's called American Association of University Professors versus Rubio. It's brought by that association of many American college professors And it's also brought by their campus chapters at Harvard, NYU, and Rutgers, as well as the Middle East Studies Association. The case was brought by another ally in this fight, the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, and that's the group where our guest, George Wang, is a staff attorney. Now, this is confronting what is called ideological deportations. And if that has any hint of what went on in the both Red Scares in connection with World War I and World War II, and the Red Scare, and then McCarthyism in the most recent example, these are deportations in which the government is openly purporting to arrest, detain, and deport non-citizen students and faculty, many of whom are legal permanent residents who participate in pro-Palestinian activism. Marco Rubio is the defendant because, as Secretary of State, he is claiming the right to deport these individuals because they pose a threat to American foreign policy. It's a dangerous concept. It carries over from a statute from the 1950s. Many people believe that statute is unconstitutional. This case may give an opportunity to prove that. But short of that, what's so important about this case is it is one of the first trials. Now, we've been talking a lot today about injunctions, preliminary proceedings. This is a trial going on in Boston with witnesses being called and cross-examined, documentary evidence being introduced. The Knight First Amendment Institute is producing a record of how the Secretary of State and his underlings are using the ideology of these students and faculty members as a basis to deport them. The trial judge denied an effort to dismiss, and we are getting live reports from the trial, and I encourage folks to go to the Knight First Amendment Institute website. They are reporting, and the disclosures by some of these witnesses is extraordinary. We are learning how the State Department is using websites. There's a website called Canary, which purport to catalog evidence of anti-Israel sentiments and pro-Palestinian activism, all of which is protected by the First Amendment. We're hopeful that the trial judge, William Young, in Massachusetts, will issue a ruling shortly after the trial. And we're hoping that on the grounds that the First Amendment is implicated. And my final thought on this is it's not only the right of those students to protest, the right of the faculty, the right of student clubs to organize, to express viewpoints which others may disagree with, but actually it's the right of everyone in the campus setting to hear what the protesters have to say. The Supreme Court established a right to hear, a right to receive information. All of us are injured when a government censors and punishes free speech, because then we are denied the opportunity to hear, to judge, to analyze, maybe to agree with, maybe to disagree with, but certainly not to face that kind of censorship. I'm hopeful that theory of the case will prevail. Also, it's vague in terms of what the State Department is doing, and it violates the Administrative Procedures Act. I genuinely hope all listeners will follow the case of AAUP versus Rubio at the Knight First Amendment Institute.
Steve, we're running at the end of our allotted time here, but let's conclude by letting me ask you, tell the listeners where they can hear more from you and your in-depth analysis of these important issues.
Well, first of all, I'm very grateful to Law and Disorder and this audience. I'm pleased to be your co-host on other shows, and folks know that they can continue to listen to this show for this kind of clear, I hope, information as well. Likewise, on the Pacifica Network, I'm on the Lawyers Guild show with Maria Hall, co-host today, and our colleague Jim Lafferty. My writing is available at laprogressive.com, Truth Dig, the LA Review of Books. And I'm very pleased that I have a new podcast, Speaking Freely, a First Amendment podcast produced by Miz Studios, that's available on all kinds of platforms, Apple and iHeartRadio and Spotify and Miz Studios itself, where I take a look at the important First Amendment cases that the Supreme Court has decided. I'm committed to the fact that when listeners understand the law, they understand what's at stake, we're going to have a much better chance of resisting the current administration and building a society based on constitutional rights, including freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
There are times in history when nothing happens for decades, and other times when decades happen within days. This is what V.I. Lenin observed, and he should know. He was the leader of the Russian Revolution, which overthrew the feudal Tsar and changed the history of the 20th century. We are living in a time when history is unfolding very rapidly. Trump and his coterie of the upper 0.1%, aligned with the mostly lower middle class MAGA movement, have taken huge steps upending and overturning the kind of democracy, however limited by race and class, that we have lived with since gaining our independence from England 250 years ago. We are experiencing the transition to a new absolutist executive. Trump and the ideologues who have shaped his MAGA movement is a president who acts on the premise that whatever he does is lawful. He claimed full power to close down departments like the Department of Education, impound congressionally authorized spending, deport people without due process while ignoring the courts. This is what he calls a unitary executive. The classic definition of fascism is that it's one of the political forms that capitalism may assume in its monopoly imperial phase. It has a material foundation in a tenuous alliance between sectors of the extremely rich monopoly capitalists and a mobilized lower middle class. The key to fascist rule is the privatization of large parts of the government on behalf of the monopoly class. This ideology is now ensconced in the White House. The right wing is opposed to environmental governance. They don't believe in climate change. They're against open borders, universal health care, and green energy. Those who advocate for these beneficial movements are called cultural Marxists. They refer in a derogatory way to all contemporary progressive political causes. They call it woke. They use the term as a means to belittle all social justice struggles against racism and inequality. Its most common usage is as a racist dog whistle. These fascists want to secure their rule by getting control of the entire cultural apparatus of society, a process the Nazis, the German fascists of their time, called bringing it into line. The current attack on universities is the most recent example. We speak today with returning guest John Bellamy Foster. Foster is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon. He's a prominent scholar on ecology and the author of many books, including Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Professor Foster is the editor of the venerable socialist magazine Monthly Review
and the author of the article, The MAGA Ideology and the Trump Regime, in its most recent May 2025 issue. Professor Foster, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Pleased to be here.
John, you understand what is happening in the United States. You've written that, quote, "We're experiencing the transition to a new absolute executive. It's a process of unfolding neo-fascism," end quote. You write that fascism is one of the political forms that capitalism may assume. What are the characteristics of fascism in the United States?
Well, I think we have to go back to 2008, at the time of the great financial crisis. And there were three things that happened at that time from the standpoint of the ruling class or the oligarchy. One was the great financial crisis itself, which threatened a complete meltdown of the system and enormous losses to capital, both in the United States and globally, which was a frightening prospect for those at the top, especially. The second thing was that in the context of that crisis, there was a revolt of a kind coming from mainly from lower middle class, small property holders, small investors. And they formed what we call the Tea Party revolt and all of that at that time. And it became clear that the lower middle class, predominantly white, could be a militant force in the society that could be mobilized. The third thing that happened, although it wasn't apparent fully for maybe a year, was that the Chinese economy was affected by the crisis momentarily and then leaped back up again to an enormously high rate of economic growth, while the entire West and most of the world was in negative growth. And that signaled that China was a threat to the capitalist system in a new way they had not perceived before, that Chinese economic growth was almost unstoppable. So these three things came together in the viewpoint of the ruling capitalist class: the danger of financial meltdown and severe economic crisis under present circumstances, that monopoly finance capital was vulnerable, the threat of China, and the fact that there was a potential to mobilize a lower middle class. And all of this set the stage for the development of what we call neo-fascism in the United States, and which is basically an alliance between monopoly capital of finance and lower middle class, predominantly lower middle class, which is mobilized to transform the system. Fascism, movements in the fascist genus are not an entirely different system. It's the antonym of fascism isn't socialism. Rather, fascism is a form of regime under capitalism that is aimed at the destruction of liberal democracy, which is the normal political regime of capitalism. And so it's a very dangerous phenomenon that only emerges in times of severe crisis.
Well, John, Trump and his MAGA movement claim that the president could, well, close down government departments like the Department of Education. They claim that they can impound congressionally authorized spending, ignore court decisions, all based on the power of the executive. Are they saying that whatever the president does is by definition therefore lawful?
Yeah, that's the general tendency. In fact, the major theorists of MAGA, people like Michael Anton and Curtis Yarvin and many others I could note, were saying precisely that. If Trump was back in office, he could operate as Caesar. In a fascist type regime, neo-fascist type of regime, they they claim to adhere to the Constitution, but they interpret the Constitution, and this was even true for Nazi Germany, an earlier form of fascism. They claim that the Constitution allows the executive to have singular power, to the executive to control the society in general. In Nazi Germany, there was what we call the Führer principle. They declared that whatever the Führer did was law. And there's this tendency to say that whatever the executive, in this case Trump, does is law. So they say that although Congress allocates funds to various programs, the executive branch or the president has the power to zero out those funds, to eliminate the funds altogether. Not necessarily the organization that's set up, but to remove the funding, which then is effectively to eliminate the organization. They also claim that there is what's called a unilateral executive. I mean, the first principle, zeroing out the funding, is called the impoundment principle. It's a constitutional theory. They also have a constitutional theory called unilateral executive that says that the president has authority over the independent agencies, that they're not really independent, so that the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Transportation Commission, even the Federal Reserve Board are not really independent in the sense that the unilateral executive gives the president complete authority over them. So, and then there's various provisions for declaring national emergencies. And there are various laws, like, as you know, the Anti-Sedition Acts or the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which give enormous emergency power to the president. I mean, the president always has martial law authority, but the president is interpreted as having the power to declare emergencies in all sorts of areas, that which allow the president then to transgress the law and even the Constitution. So all of these powers are being enlisted, creating a constitutional crisis, because what is happening is that the separation of powers is being eliminated and everything is being concentrated in the executive.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. This is Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with John Bellamy Foster. John, the right-wing ideology of the MAGA movement is against what they call cultural Marxism. What do they claim is cultural Marxism?
So there are all sorts of attacks on cultural Marxism. And really, the way they define it is they say cultural Marxism is not like original Marxism, which they see as a form of economic determinism. That isn't correct, but it doesn't matter. The what they call cultural Marxism, they say started with Antonio Gramsci in Italy and then spread to what's called the Frankfurt School, that thinkers like Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno and Herbert Marcuse, and spread into the United States and led to approaches like critical race theory and gender ideology and so on. And they claim that cultural Marxism dominates not only the universities, but also the government, and that programs like DEI and critical race theory, DEI means diversity, equity, and inclusion, those kinds of programs, critical race theory and so on, are all part of cultural Marxism. They say cultural Marxism is the theory behind woke, to which they attribute all the faults of the society. And they say cultural Marxism dominates the administrative state, the state apparatus in the United States, so they had to destroy the administrative state to destroy cultural Marxism. This isn't just the Project 2025 when they issued the executive order at closing down federal spending a week after Trump came into power. They, in the executive order, it says that they are attacking cultural Marxism. And all of the executive orders include charges like this.
Well, John, you've written in Monthly Review that the new fascism in the United States is based on a, and I quote, tenuous alliance between sections of the monopoly ruling class at the top of society and on the immobilized army of a lower middle class adherents from below, close quote. Is this kind of alliance characteristic of all fascist movements?
Yeah, fascism got redefined by liberal theorists, and particularly in the 1980s, as just some kind of extreme racist, revanchist ideology that and it got defined in purely ideological terms. But the original understanding of fascism, if you go back to the 1930s, was the Marxist class-based understanding of fascism as a political formation, which was really kind of a universal understanding of fascism, so that Franz Neumann's Behemoth, which was a Marxist analysis of fascism in Hitler Germany, was used in the Nuremberg trials. The classical notion of fascism is class-based, and it's based on the notion of an alliance that is formed, a political alliance between the monopoly capitalist elements, or monopoly finance capital at the top of the society, particularly sectors of that, but perhaps the monopoly finance capital class as a whole, and the petty bourgeoisie or lower middle class, and sort of small property owners and lower level white collar employees and rural workers and so on. That a sector of society ends up being mobilized by big capital to combat liberal democracy and what is seen as the political elites. But the lower middle class is also is mobilized not only against the upper middle class, but also against the working class below it. It does not generally attack the capitalist class itself. So you have this alliance, a very dangerous alliance, where the lower middle class, which tends to be nationalist and racist and so on, especially if operating on the basis of their own ideology, and revanchist in the sense of claiming that they want to restore an idyllic past, that class sector is mobilized by the capitalist class against the liberal democracy, against the upper middle class or professional managerial strata, and against the working class. And in the MAGA ideology, it isn't the capitalist class that's the ruling class in the United States. It's actually the administrative state and those who control the administrative state, which means for them, the upper middle class and the working class are really upper middle class elites, and the working class control the administrative state, which is geared to their needs and not to either capital or to the lower middle class. So it's a very dangerous phenomenon because of this link between billionaires and this very disenchanted lower middle class that is afraid of falling into the working class and feels oppressed by the state.
John Bellamy Foster, you have predicted that the billionaire class at the top will ultimately betray the base. Why is that? And is that happening already?
It is happening in various ways. this is the nature of fascism, is this alliance between, let's say, the billionaire class today or monopoly finance capital and the lower middle class. And of course, it tries to target mass of the working class and the poor, and to target what they see as the liberal elite or the professional managerial class. But it also ends up targeting MAGA movement itself and the lower middle class. The MAGA movement, for example, you know, you have people like Steve Bannon who don't want the immigration preferences for that are given to employees from abroad that corporations bring in. They see that as anti-American and opposed to. But Trump always sides with the billionaire class when there's that kind of direct conflict. And so we see people like Bannon being pushed aside. So the radical MAGA is always kind of being betrayed. We see a situation now where with the high tariffs, this is going to strike Trump's lower middle class followers. And even the cuts in Medicaid will affect them. The high inflation rates will affect them. The Trump latest answer to high inflation rates is to discontinue the statisticians within the government, statisticians who construct the consumer price index. They're no longer going to be allowed to go into the grocery stores to check on prices. By eliminating the data, they can sort of downplay the amount of inflation in the society. The whole attack on the working class actually flows over into attacks on the lower middle class. It's the interests of the oligarchy or the billionaires that is dominant here. And Trump, you know, actually presented himself as a peace candidate, but the capitalist class, the global monopoly finance capital, U.S. style, is headed more and more towards war to maintain its hegemony. So the MAGA ideology is being betrayed in some ways. The MAGA movement is being betrayed in all these different sorts of ways. And this will result in more repression, especially you can expect a repression of those elements, those radical MAGA elements that defy Trump.
Well, John, you predict that the next chapter in this fascist program is to get control of the entire cultural apparatus of society in the process of what you write, and I quote, the Nazis called bringing it into line, close quote. Would that include everything from public broadcasting, critical legacy media, independent media like the stations affiliated with the Pacifica Foundation, including stations that, well, broadcast our show, Law and Disorder?
Yes, of course. This is a product not just of Trump, but of the whole MAGA movement. First of all, the nature of fascism, or neo-fascism, as we can call it in this case, to gain control by way of what the Germans called Gleichschaltung, or bringing into line, synchronization. They can't defeat all of their enemies in a headlong assault, but what they do is threaten and undermine institutions, and are able to do that by getting the liberal elements, those who ostensibly stand for a liberal democracy and that aspect of capitalism, to back away, to simply for their own safety or in order to adapt, they give in stages. So this is the strategy. The strategy is first to take over the administrative state, or eliminate the administrative state, as they call it. Then to go after the entire cultural apparatus, which is part of the state, or sort of the level of civil society that's tied to the state. They're going after education and the media, are major targets. So the attack on Harvard, for example, is part of an attempt to gain control of the cultural apparatus, leading MAGA theorists like Rufo. But this is really part of the overall ideology to break down. The universities are seen as hotbeds of cultural Marxism, critical race theory, DEI. So they have to be brought into line by threats and punishment and getting them to agree to the Trump program. And the media is obviously a target, too. In the first Trump administration, they actually tried to go after the media right at the start. You can remember Bannon's actions, for example. But they've been a little bit slower in attacking the media this time around. But that's the goal, is to get the media to conform, to fall into line, to stop questioning, not to fight back, but to hedge and back away and pretend that they're not part of the Trump project, but simply acceding with everything it does. Now, if you look at the big, beautiful bill, they also inserted a provision to eliminate funding for nonprofit corporations that in some way defend terrorists, right? And according to the definitions of the executive, any organization, any media organization that supports Palestinians in the context of the Israeli genocide in Gaza is liable to lose their nonprofit status. But also the notion of the universal executive, the idea is that the Trump administration can use the FCC if it wants to eliminate the license of any media organization. So we're going to see threats along that line, and the media, the media will basically, since they're profit-making corporations, most of them will go along, while left media may simply be crushed because they can do that. So we have this looming threat. The entire cultural apparatus is in danger. They're removing black exhibits, the exhibits on black history from the Smithsonian. Trump is moving funds away from the from the NEA and the NEH and giving them to his statues of heroes. You know, it's all part of an attempt to change the cultural dimensions of society. He attacks degenerate art just like Hitler did. He has used the term degenerate art. They're proposing to eliminate that and replace that with a nationalist populist art.
Well, John, sadly, we are out of time, but before we let you go, how can people follow your work? How, for example, can they, obtain the monthly review?
Well, monthly review is easy to find. You just have to Google monthly review and it pops up right away. And monthly review exists in a print edition as well. It's designed really for a print edition. And monthly review is very available. It may not be visible in the media, but we're definitely there and easy to find.
Thank you very much, John Bellamy Foster. Thank you for being our guest on Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the lawsuit American Association of University Professors versus Rubio, which challenges federal efforts to deport individuals for their political activism and ideology.
Attorney George Wang of the Knight First Amendment Institute joins us to unpack the case.
Then we'll take an insider's look at Louisville, Kentucky's Office of Inspector General, established after the 2020 political police killing of Breonna Taylor.
Inspector General Ed Harness joins us to discuss the role of independent oversight within the Louisville Metro Police Department. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. Sadly, listeners to Law and Disorder are all too familiar with how the Trump administration has systematically created a climate of repression and fear on our university campuses. Federal agencies are attempting to deport multiple individuals for their pro-Palestinian advocacy, including Mahmoud Khalil, a leader of the pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University. These actions have sent chills through the community of non-citizen students and faculty on campuses around the country, causing some to pull out of academic conferences, stay home from protests, and withdraw from other forms of public advocacy and engagement. While Khalil and other students are actively pursuing their own lawsuits and habeas corpus petitions defending their own First Amendment rights, the Knight
reminds you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.